Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining me on Broadcast Focus. My name is Russell Trafford-Jones. Here on Broadcast Focus, we like to look at the media industries. We talk to the people who make up the industries, and whether we're talking about technology or we're talking about the industry itself, it's interesting and it's great to have such a wide variety of topics to choose from. There's always things happening, new things coming along, whether that is in the new technology or in this case, there is new legislation on its way, perhaps. We don't know. And we've seen this recently in the UK, where the government was trying to pin down spam robocalling and spam SMSs. And they really wanted to bring in some new legislation to stop the sale and production of equipment with multiple SIMs. Of course, that's a big problem for the industry, particularly if you want to go out on the street with 16 SIMs in your on the back of your camera and put something back live into your news channel. So that didn't go down too well, but we were able to come together and actually have useful and proactive conversations as an industry in multiple different bodies, both directly as companies, but also with companies like, organizations like the IABM. So, you know, this can work. And, you know, in many ways, governments and people who are making policy need that feedback. And that's one of the topics we're going to be talking about today, because I'm very pleased to introduce to you Greg Poland. Hello.
Hello, Russell. Thanks for having me on the show. Very well. Thank you.
So I've asked you to come on the show, and I really appreciate you taking the time, particularly to duck in at short notice, to talk about something which you've been tracking for a while now. And I think the interest is in the fact that these things brew. And I think particularly with such an active industry, such as the media industry, I often feel we're so worried about getting new projects underway and getting new productions going that we kind of forget that there's this whole political machine doing things in the background. And the people who do need to work all the time in the UK with Ofcom, etc., you know, we've got a lot of stuff to do, and they sort all this out. And then we know that they go every few years, and we all chat about frequencies and make sure everybody's happy that we're not on each other's frequencies, and that kind of happens, right? But then sometimes something important happens, and we're talking about geoblocking today. So before we get into the meat of the matter, it'd be really great if you could tell us a little bit about, you know, yourself and what you do within ACT.
Of course. So my full name is actually Grégoire Paulad, so I'm a French national, but I've been fortunate enough to live quite a long time in the UK, so I'm a bit familiar with the system over there. I've been leading the ACT now for the past 8 years. The ACT is short for, and bear with me, Association of Commercial Television and Video on Demand Services in Europe. So thank you for putting that up. So our main goal is to be the voice of broadcasters and their associated VOD services in Europe. What does that mean? Well, essentially, the association was founded in 1989. To those who are a bit familiar with European legislation, that's the same year that the Television Without Frontiers directive came up. What is that? That's the foundational, or some would say kind of like the constitution of European law for audiovisual media services. Today, this directive has moved on. It's called the Audiovisual Media Services Directive. And our role since all of these years has been to obviously represent commercial television and more recently now video on demand services, given the change in services in the market. And we have been focusing, of course, on everything that has to do with EU law and its impact, because as you were rightly saying, yes, it's already a very complicated, it's a very complicated ecosystem. There's a lot happening, but there is always the government that's there, and we're amongst probably the most regulated sectors out there. So yes, broadcasters always have kind of a silent partner called the government, and we are always on the lookout to see indeed what will come out of Brussels and how that impacts different broadcasters in different European member states, but also in the UK, as obviously there's still a lot from the AVMS directive that's still implemented over there. So for us, yes, we have a broad remit of looking at everything from AV law to IP to data, to competition issues and much more, because God knows that regulators can be quite creative when they want to.
Okay, so everything you do really is focused on talking to the government and helping make sure that decisions are made with the right information and hopefully in the right direction.
Indeed. We look at the supranational level, so that is to say European institutions, of which there are many, but the three key ones for anybody who's doing lobbying in Brussels are basically, one, the European Parliament, and we'll talk about that in a bit with regard to the specific report, which, as you know, we used to have British MEPs, no longer is the case, but has plus 700 members of Parliament who review laws. Then we have the European Commission, of course, which initiates laws, so has the duty of basically saying, okay, X, Y, and Z work program for this year in terms of what we want to regulate or change. And to do this, it can use two forms of instrument, basically, either a regulation or a directive. Regulation tend to be applied immediately, just basically transferred immediately to member state level. Directives give a little bit more flexibility for national parliaments to adapt them. And then we have the Council of Europe, so Council of Ministers, sorry. And these are essentially the diplomats of the various member states coming together in Brussels to represent the views of the member states. So just to make it very easy, the European Commission initiates the legislation in most cases, then the Parliament and Council review it in parallel, and all three come together at the end of the day to look at the legislation and come up with an agreement. And okay. Those are our main partners here in Brussels.
Okay, cool. So so geo-blocking is what we're talking about. So they're mm-hmm. thinking of changing the rules on geo-blocking. And if they do, without going into too much detail yet, that could significantly impact the ability of broadcasters and streamers alike to geo-block within the mm-hmm. EU. So you know, why is it that the EU... care about geo-blocking? Like, you know, what is it that they feel is important that there needs to be a rule about that? Because I'm sure in other countries, nobody's really thinking about it or cares too much.
Well, I think there's a principle base, and then there's also a reality of people that are in Brussels, because as you rightly point out, I don't think Danes wake up on a regular basis or Belgians or Portuguese for that matter, you know, going to the streets and screaming out loud, why is there geo-blocking? For Europe, I think there's a principle base, which is the single market doctrine, which is very strong and tends to say, and with many good consequences, by the way, for many consumers out there, in terms of saying, well, we have one market and we must treat it as one market. And therefore, you know, anything that's blocking basically circulation of goods and services and people needs to be tackled. And we've seen some great things done by Europe in that matter. But also, we've also seen, you know, kind of extreme interpretations of this, where sectors that, such as audiovisual, are inherently national in their approach and in their markets. And where, rightly so, the Commission has said, well, there are forms of geo-blocking that are illegitimate, such as services, in terms of if you want to buy a pair of shoes, for example, online, you shouldn't be blocked in your national country, in your member state. But there are some that are legitimate, as in audiovisual. And that is because, obviously, and we'll get into the detail, that's because of the financing issue of audiovisual and why we need. I mean, I think to your viewers, it'll come as no surprise that everything that has to do with territorial exclusivity, with basically contractual freedom, is very much fundamental to the industry's financing and working. So that's for the principal part. And in terms of reflecting the reality of the Brussels bubble and people here, this report that we are seeing today is not coming from the Commission, it's coming from the Parliament. And parliamentarians in Brussels are people who live here quite a lot and spend quite a lot of their time in Brussels. And for some of them, it's become an issue, quite a personal issue, that they are not able to access their TV shows when they are in Brussels for the period that they are here. As such, it creates force, if you want, for change there, when the economic rationale isn't necessarily there, to be honest.
Well, yeah, I think it's, you know, you've got to remember there are people at the heart of everything. And it is annoying, right? You know, you pay your license fee, you pay your subscription, you go on holiday and you can't watch it, right? So not that I'm saying they're going on holiday when they go to Brussels.
Well, there is a notable difference to that is that, well, the reality is that for subscription services, the EU has regulated on this already. So we do have a law called the portability of services law, which basically allows you, if you subscribe to a service, to be able to access it when you are on holiday or abroad. So that is already thought of by the European legislator. So that in essence is not the issue. And we think we've covered most of the demand there. It's the other part, which is more complicated.
So the idea, the issue that you're bringing to light is that, that the idea of this legitimate geo-blocking, which is where you've got a good reason to stop people outside of your area being able to access the service, is now potentially going to change. And that's going to now, for the first time, if this goes through, is going to actually impact the ability of broadcasters to say no. And, you know, I seem to remember with trying to read books, you know, whether it's audio books or particularly with audio books, but you know, there just seems the way the book world and the publishers worked was ultra nationalistic, and it was really difficult even for an author to get their book to be available in the UK and, you know, and in Australia and in America. They wanted to do these individual deals, and that seemed like perhaps if it's true as far as I've described it, that seems like perhaps a slightly more extreme version of what we have to deal with when we're dealing with rights to particularly with sport, but absolutely any IP rights, whether it's game shows or anything that you need to have a license to. You know, do you get the streaming rights? Do you get the broadcast rights? Which country are you allowed to do it in? Is that fair to say that there's a lot of, you don't get a lot when you're signing up for these rights. You really are only allowed to do a very small number of things in a very specific area.
Yeah, I can't speak for the book sector, but what I can say is that there's a reason why there are limits to usage and how can you use those licenses, because obviously licenses can be done in many different ways, but they're done optimally in order to make sure that the seller and the buyer find the optimum agreement. Also, bear in mind that a lot of this covers pre-financing of content. So when you're making a movie, a lot of times, if, for example, you're in a co-production setup, well, people will come up and say, well, I want the rights for Germany because I'm a broadcaster for Germany. And I'll say, okay, so that means you get the rights for Germany for this and this usage. And you'll say, fine, and that's what I'm ready to pay for. In return for that, I want exclusivity. Because in our industry, probably compared more to other industries, unlike music or books, exclusivity, well, I mean, books probably a bit more, but exclusivity is key. Right. If you are going to be showing a show, or if you are going to be showing a movie, you want to be sure that you are the one that has that right. It's not always the case, but it's generally the case, because obviously it's what attracts people to buy subscriptions or to come and see your channel at night, or to see your VOD service, as you can see, right? On every time you go on a VOD service, they're advertising that content because they know that's what consumers want to see. So it's really leading in customers into the service. And therefore, it's super important as much for the people that use it as for the people that sell it.
Yeah. So there's a vote coming up, which is one of the motivations for speaking about this now. And what I want to do is, ahead of talking specifically about that vote and what we can do to have our say, I'm going to have a quick look at some of the information that's available. Now, you've worked with a company over the years to get data and information about the use and potential harms and benefits of this type of geo-blocking. Can you say a little bit more about how you've gone about getting the information?
Sure. Well, I think what we've done, and specifically the report you referred to here, is from Oliver Nolbaum, with whom, you know, we've worked in the past with other industry stakeholders, to ask them a little bit to look at, you know, what would happen if you were to change the regime, right? If you were to say, okay, there is no more exclusivity. We try and change the regime. Give us a little sneak peek on what would be the impact, not only for us, but of course for consumers and for other industry participants. And I think generally the findings here, point to the fact that obviously, you know, this is a big industry. This is where we start, right? People often forget that if you take the creative and cultural industries in Europe, it's one of the top three sectors in Europe. It's huge. It's one of those industries also where we're very much, you know, exporting formats abroad, so net trade surplus in certain categories, and it's an element of soft power, right, in the world, in terms of Europe's projection of identities inside and outside of Europe. So what ONO did is they went out there and basically mapped out what would happen if we did this. They did a four economic study, and what they found is that, of course, the producers would lose a lot, right? You just passed through, but looking at 8.2 billion in terms of, you know, impact on producer revenues. Also, you know, looking at basically the output reduction, because if you're not able to finance it, well, you're not able to create it, so you're not able to have output. And that's almost up to half of the output that we have for TV films and series. So it's quite big. And then, of course, there's a repercussion on the consumers. So what does that mean in terms of repercussion on the consumer? Because you could say, well, wait, actually, it's only you guys losing money out here. What would be the issue? But the fact is that if you don't allow geo-blocking anymore, then what you're essentially saying to industry participants is you can sell, but you need to have a pan-European license. You need to sell across Europe. And so that means for certain players, it's affordable. But for many other players, they can't actually buy it, right? Imagine a small Bulgarian channel trying to buy, you know, Premier League rights. They wouldn't be able to because it's way too expensive, or for that matter, any kind of popular series. So that the many people talk about geo-blocking as geo-enabling, because essentially it allows, you know, smaller market players to buy content at lower prices. If there was no geo-blocking, then they'd have to buy at much larger prices, and they probably wouldn't. So there would basically lead to the end of a lot of services across Europe, because it's the kind of content that draws in audiences.
Yeah. So, presumably the people selling the rights aren't going to say, yeah, okay, I'll sell it to you exclusive in Germany, but I don't mind if you don't geo-block it, because I know you're not allowed to. We'll just hope not too many Italians tune in, right? That doesn't seem likely to happen. So it then becomes a pan-European problem, and it's expensive.
Well, it's that. I mean, you've had also judgments, right, in the past from the Court of Justice, where basically the commission was trying to force certain providers to say, look, you can't put in your contract something saying that, you know, to the extent that people aren't allowed to have passive sales. And so that's a bit of a legalese word to say, well, you're not allowed to ban people who want to buy a subscription in the UK market, say, from doing it from Spain. Or vice versa, or elsewhere. And what was found after there was an appeals process launched is that at the end of the day, you need this kind of setup, because if you don't actually ban the passive sales, it impacts those broadcasters that are trying to get exclusivity in that territory, but no longer would be able to. So take, for example, if there's a great, you know, if there's a service in Germany and all Spaniards want to take advantage of that and go and ask for to have, you know, subscription there, well, then what happens to the Spanish broadcaster that bought the rights in the first place? He's not going to get an audience there. And so therefore, it's going to create a vicious cycle of downward spiral in prices. And to the point where, you know, the only people who are going to win out of that, if they do, and even those big services are not for it, are going to be the extremely large VOD services that have very, very large pockets.
Just bringing this up because this is, I know that you've, these are respondents to one of these surveys, but there, I know that you've worked with a number of these people to actually get the survey underway to start with. And, you know, what's interesting here is we've got, you know, large names, NBC, Universal, AE Networks, EMEA, Sony Pictures, but there's also, you know, plenty of smaller ones. And it's from, am I right in thinking it's from the film side as well, or the production side as much as the broadcaster side?
From all sides. I think if there is one thing that is remarkable with this topic is there is a uniform view across the industry that this mechanism needs to be kept, because without it, everybody ends up losing, from the producer to the director to the actors to you know, the distributors, the broadcasters, the VOD providers, you name it. I think across the chain there is not one single issue I know out there that unites people as much as keeping contractual freedom and territorial exclusivity, because it's a win-win for everyone, literally.
One thing I remember is I heard this a number of times, when European broadcasters, particularly public broadcasters, but not exclusively, are asked how are they fighting against the Netflix and the, you know, the hyperscaler giant global streamers, they start talking about being able to do local programming, right? You know, we just you know, Netflix can't do like a Netherlands style thing, and they can't then also go and do a Bulgarian drama. You know, we're focused on that. And, you know, that is, as far as they can see, that's one of their main differentiators. And so it seems equally wrong to say, well, okay, you're not, you know, you now have to make that available pan-European, because that's kind of making them, you know, do exactly the same thing as the hyperscalers. Now, sure, fine. It's still the local produce that perhaps other companies can't replicate easily. And it certainly looks like that Netflix's endless budget for doing productions is not necessarily as endless as we originally were led to believe. But, you know, it feels like this is going against the spirit of that, you know, being able to hunker down and say, right, we're proud of our culture, our language, and the types of programs we produce. We'll produce that for our nation, for our people, and the people who understand that and can really resonate with that. And, you know, if you mess around with the geo-blocking, it feels like you're undermining their ability to fight against and maintain their uniqueness.
I think it's certainly a narrative you'll hear from certain industry participants, but there is a wider, I think there's a tendency to try and always make this us versus them narrative. Mm-hmm. But the reality is, if you look at the market, everybody's working with everyone. You know, it's everybody commissions from everyone, everybody buys rights from everyone. So it's not so clear cut that it's, you know, oh, the big VODs versus the smaller, the Europeans versus the Americans. It's, I mean, I think it's tempting to see it that way, but it's not the reality of the market. And secondly, you are quite right that there are certain distinctive points that every service tries to get, right? In terms of saying, okay, we are known for this. That's the basis of strategy, right? To strategize is to differentiate. But for I'd say for broadcasters or traditional broadcasters, as you named them, indeed, the local element is very strong. The live element is very strong. The news element is very strong. So going back to the issue of, you know, geo-blocking and territorial exclusivity, the whole point about when you buy or when you commission or when you're doing any types of form of programming, there's what people tend to forget is it's not just a piece of meat, right? The piece of content has contextualization. You need to bring it to the market. You need to explain it to the audiences. You need to put it in a way that it makes them feel that somehow they can relate to it. There's a whole amount of work that goes behind that. And so indeed, saying, well, it's easy to flick a switch and make it a pan-European thing, completely negates the reality of how you frame these and how you distribute them and how you eventually create an audience for them.
Mm-hmm. So there's been a general reassessment through since the beginning, if I'm correct in saying, since the beginning of this idea of putting in legislation behind what a legitimate geo-blocking activity is. And so every few years there's been a reassessment and an understanding. You've been following that and producing a survey over those times, and we've got survey information. We had a brief look at 2016, and I think there's 2020. So now what? Now the latest is that they are actively talking about including the AV market. So in this case, we're talking about any of the media companies. That in, I believe it's next week that they are. Is that an official vote for the end? What's actually happening in the 13th? Where are we in this process? Because I'm sure it's not going to be a quick process, sure. But we might be near the end. Who knows?
Yes, it's always a bit complicated with European processes. So just to clarify, there is, as I mentioned earlier, there is a piece of law, which is a geo-blocking regulation in Europe, which applies across the entire EU and covers services that are deemed to be, you know, illegitimate to geo-block. AV is not in there. Now, that was done by the Commission, applied by the member states, and it's reviewed every 2 years by the Commission to see, okay, are we on the right track? Are we doing the right things? Do we have the right scope? And to this end, the Parliament will have its word to say. And the Parliament, via a report done by the Internal Market Committee, it's not a surprise, right, because it's about the geo-blocking regulation, has taken the view that in the next review, the Commission should include audiovisual media services. And this report, done by the Internal Market Committee, is indeed coming for a plenary vote next week. So why does that have everybody animated? It's not a legal report in the sense that legislation will not change in the next day. But it will give a strong political signal to people who are tempted to do so in the European Commission to push for including AV services at the next review. And there have been many attempts by certain parliamentarians to do this. In sometimes this legislation makes sense, you would say. They've tried to put it in countless number of other legislations, some that have nothing to do with AV services or geo-blocking. But, you know, everybody tries in their own way. And in this specific case, they have managed to actually get a majority in the committee to approve this. And as such, now we're facing that vote. And the sectors, and the one I represent included, do not wish to see a precedent of this nature go in there, because it would be highly damaging for all the reasons I've brought up before for the sector if that were to be part of an opinion from the European Parliament.
Understood. So you've put together a website, which I'll bring up to bring together.
I haven't. It's not my website. We're just part of that platform. But that's very nice to say. It's too nice for me to be able to put that stuff together.
There is a website.
There is a website
which brings together you know, a lot of the thoughts. It's creativityworks.eu. Geo-blocking campaign. We can see that here on the screen at the moment. It's bringing it down into three sections: the general, you know, EU-wide economic impact, employment impact, and consumer. And I think what's nice here is that it is easily it was easy to read, easy to understand, and you know, it's for everybody to take their view based upon this information and others. In the description, I'll put a link to the EU report, so you can read that as well. And really, I guess, in terms of action, if people have an opinion, you know, assuming they're in the EU, presumably, you know, do they have to be part of the industry directly in order to, or be a company in order to make their opinions felt to their MEP?
No, I mean, that's the beauty of European democracy and democracy in general, right? If you feel strongly about an issue and you want to write to your MEP, I suggest that you go to the European Parliament's webpage. All the MEPs are there, categorized by parties, groups, member states. Their emails are readily available, and if you wish to write to them ahead of the vote on Wednesday to tell them that you don't think this is a good idea, please be my guest. That's part of you expressing your democratic right to be heard. I think for us, it's clear that it's more than an industry issue. It's something that will, if followed through by the European Commission, cause quite a bit of harm.
And are there any other groups which are backing this or making a noise either way? Or your silent body of interested parties? Sorry,
There are
solid body.
many. No, no, there are many, interested parties. I think as I was saying before, the entire industry is very much aligned on this at all levels. So we have trade unions making very, very positive appeals to the European Parliament, industry bodies as well. We think I'm not spoiling this, but there will be a letter with probably over 250 organizations across Europe trying to mobilize MEPs to amend the report, which is important. So no, we're definitely not alone out there in terms of support, but there's never enough support to show that this is an issue that will definitely impact our sector. And if you know where our sector is right now, probably we want to focus on other challenges than try and move the fundamentals of the business.
Yeah. Indeed. Well, that's a very good point. Thank you for that. So, I'm going to thank you very much for joining me, Greg. It's been really interesting, and it's great to see under the hood of what's happening in the EU. And yeah, I think it's important. And whether anybody listening to this feels that they're strongly either way, I think it's really interesting. It's really interesting to think about the ways that the industry works, and the ways it would have to adapt. And so I'm really pleased that you're able to come on and raise this issue so that we can learn more. So very much appreciate that. Thank you.
Absolute pleasure, Russell. Thanks for having me.
Excellent. So just remains for me to say, I think this is the sixth episode. So clearly Broadcast Focus is a very new channel. Any support is much appreciated. So whether that's subscribing, liking, commenting, or just emailing Greg to say thank you, I think it would be fantastic if you take some sort of action, even if there's not an MEP involved. So thank you very much for joining me, and I look forward to speaking to you next time. Bye.